Thanks for that warm introduction. I've titled my talk, Timbuktu and the Origins of an Integrated America. And I want to do three things. I want to sketch out what Timbuktu was and describe how it came into being. And I also want to describe at length what I see as its significance to American history and American reform, hence the end of my title, The Origins of an Integrated America. And finally, I want to look at what the limits of Timbuktu were in its efforts to reform America, and in one sense, its failure. And what I'm going to do, and my talk is focused really on four individuals who I see are the principal actors in conception, development, and settlement of Timbuktu. And you're probably familiar with at least three of the four: John Brown, Garrett Smith, the wealthy land baron from Peterborough, James McKeown Smith, who's the least known. He was the first professionally trained black physician in America, the foremost black intellectual before W.E.B. Du Bois. He was born and bred in New York City. He received his MD degree at the University of Glasgow and then returned to America in 1837. And the fourth one is Frederick Douglass, the most famous black man in the Western world by the mid-1850s. All of them either were born and bred or ended up settling in New York State around the time that Timbuktu came into being. So let me start by saying, what was Timbuktu? Was really three things. It was a place, it was literally a community, but it was also an idea, and it was a catalyst. Let me start with the place. It was a community around Lake Placid, consisting of roughly 100 black settlers who had been poor men from the state of New York who settled there with John Brown and his family. Timbuktu got its start in 1846 when Garrett Smith decided to give away roughly 120,000 acres of land to some 3,000 poor blacks from the state of New York, primarily in Franklin and Essex County. And so that amounted to roughly 40 acres per person of land that he sought to give to these poor New York State blacks. It constituted one of the largest philanthropic acts in 19th century America, particularly when you consider that this land, these 220,000 acres, went to individuals. Garrett Smith ultimately gave away most of his wealth over the course of his lifetime. He was one of 19th century's great philanthropists. I calculate that in today's dollars, over the course of his lifetime, he gave away anywhere from $500 million to $1.1 billion. And most of that, what makes it most significant, was to individuals. It was to poor blacks and to poor whites, to women and to men. He, in theory, did not distinguish he did not distinguish race or class or gender in terms of looking at people. That was what Timbuktu was, some as a place. But it was much more than a place, and its significance stems from it being much more than a place, and that was as an idea. Timbuktu ultimately came to represent an idea of what America could become. Timbuktu, in one sense, signified a model interracial community. It was an effect to realize the ideals of freedom and equality for both blacks and whites in America, in which they could live together in racial harmony. Timbuktu ultimately came to symbolize the realization of America's original ideals of freedom and equality, but not restricted according to racial categories. Its very name, Timbuktu, conveyed something of its promise and its hope. Garrett Smith actually called it and referred to it as the colored colony. And that's a significant name, the colored colony, because the notion of the colored colony harkens back to the idea of colonization and of the colonization society. The vast majority of whites in America at this time and throughout certainly up until the Civil War, really envisioned America as a white man's country, and literally as a white man's country. And even those whites who believed that slavery was a sin felt that the way to end slavery in America was to also rid the country of blacks. And they did that. The primary mechanism through doing that was the American Colonization Society, which got its start in 1816 and became the medium of choice, so to speak, for conservative reformers seeking to end slavery and at the same time rid the country of its black population, beginning with free blacks and ultimately in their minds with slaves. And so it was a very congenial way for slavery to be ended in this country. The notion of colonization, of colonizing blacks in Africa, back to Africa and Liberia, also would not uproot the traditional order in society. It would preserve the existing hierarchy of white men on top. It would not seek kind of social equality that an integrated America would represent. Whites, the vast majority of whites, viewed African Americans as incapable of self-government. It's one of the reasons why they couldn't conceive of blacks being part of their idea of America, because America was one of this example, this experiment in democracy, and they couldn't conceive of blacks being part of the democracy, which literally meant a kind of self-government. In fact, the vast majority of whites saw African Americans as subhuman, as innately inferior in matters of intelligence at best, and as more akin to apes than to humans at worst. And Garrett Smith, by defining this area of land in his home state and locating it in not only America but in New York, it was his way of saying blacks are part of this country. They're meant to be here. They're meant to stay here. To think of America and to define America as a free and equal country means the existence and the participation of blacks. In fact, Garrett Smith tried to transform and was partly successful in transforming his own community of Peterborough and of Smithfield into a model interracial community. He purchased the liberty of scores of slaves and in many cases helped them resettle to his community of Peterborough. He had the wealth and the power to transform Peterborough into a kind of model interracial community. He believed that blacks and whites and that all people should have full social and political rights. He also believed that blacks should receive the fruits of their own labor, that they should be able to become self-sufficient and thus resist white oppression. It was one of the inspirations for him of giving away the land. By giving 40 acres of land to these poor New York blacks, it allowed them to resist the oppressions and the racism of whites. It allowed them to kind of draw a circle around this white oppression and to reap the fruits of their own labor and to become independent. It also, quite literally, and one of the greatest sources of inspiration for Smith's gift, stemmed from his desire to have blacks achieve the suffrage in New York State. There was a New York State suffrage requirement which required blacks to own $250 of freehold property in order to vote, and roughly 40 acres of land, if improved or cultivated, would give blacks the vote in New York State. So by giving away this land, it was his efforts to make these poor blacks full citizens with full rights who were able to resist the racism and racial oppression of whites. It was also one of the reasons that he limited his deeds to men rather than men and women. First of all, women could not vote. They didn't have the suffrage. And secondly, women who were married could not own property in America at this time. Women had very few rights at this time, and Garrett, in theory, embraced women's equality, but it was one of the limits of his reform vision that he didn't carry out into practice in the way he did with blacks. Garrett's gift of land also came to represent a kind of rehearsal for the project of Reconstruction after Civil War. Most whites define freedom for blacks very differently than blacks did. Most whites could not conceive of freedom for blacks constituting blacks working for themselves. It meant blacks still working for whites and still being dependent upon them. Following the Civil War, former slaves clamored for the idea of 40 acres and a mule. And the reason they saw 40 acres and a mule is to become independent from their former masters and from whites, and to be able to receive the fruits of their own labor. In one important sense, Garrett Smith, by giving them 40 acres in 1846, offered or anticipated some of the radical projects during the Reconstruction era. He simply didn't have 3,000 mules or the money for 3,000 mules to give them to help them get started. So if Garrett Smith referred to the land that he gave away as the colored colony, settlers themselves, including John Brown, referred to it as Timbuktu. That name alone is highly significant because Timbuktu was the fabled city in West Africa that had become legendary for its racial diversity, for its tradition of scholarship, and for its cosmopolitan makeup. And so Timbuktu, from the perspective of the black settlers and from the perspective of John Brown, represented this independent black community that was located within America rather than some other foreign country. At this very time, many prominent black leaders had essentially given up hope in the idea of America as a place of equality and democracy and freedom, and had advocated black immigration, had sought to emigrate blacks to Liberia, to Haiti, to other places in order to achieve the freedom they felt that America had failed them in. And by defining their settlement around Lake Placid as Timbuktu, it was a way to say, we are independent from white racism, but we are still inherently part of America. And I think that's an important concept, because it meant that they had not given up their faith in America as a possible integrated community. Hence, really, my title, Timbuktu and the Origins of an Integrated Community. I mean, it literally was primarily an African-American community, but what it came to symbolize and represent was the possibility of a model interracial community and a society in general of blacks and whites living together in harmony. Timbuktu was also a catalyst, and it was the primary catalyst that brought together Garrett Smith, Frederick Douglass, James McCune Smith, and John Brown. Garrett Smith had known James McCune Smith before he announced his gift of land in 1846, but they were by no means friends. And he appointed James McCune Smith as one of his primary trustees to distribute the deeds. And shortly after this, James McCune Smith and Garrett Smith became extremely close friends. John Brown in 1848 was a complete bankrupt. He had failed in every business venture he had attempted in his life, and he had heard of Garrett Smith's extraordinary gift of land and went to Peterborough and introduced himself to Smith and said, you know, I'm an abolitionist. I would like to settle on those lands. I would like to help the settlers make a go of it. I would like to become the kind of community leader. And Garrett Smith and John Brown soon became kindred spirits. They negotiated an exchange whereby Garrett gave John Brown 244 acres there, and John Brown then envisioned himself or defined himself as the leader of that community. Frederick Douglass had just moved to the state of New York in 1847 into Rochester, and Frederick Douglass, one of the first things that happened to him when he moves to Rochester is he receives a letter in the mail from Garrett Smith. And the letter included a deed for 40 acres of land and 2-year subscription to his newspaper. And Douglass had never even met Smith. Didn't even know who he buried. I mean, he knew Smith, who Smith was, but had never met him. It was a kind of housewarming present to the state for a fellow ally in the cause. And Frederick Douglass, once he became more familiar with the project of Garrett Smith's land and the gift, he was an enormous champion of it in his newspaper and encouraged blacks to settle there and understood its importance and its significance to the project of ending slavery and racial oppression. And so, in quite literal sense, Garrett Smith's gift brought the four men together. In fact, John Brown and Frederick Douglass were the only ones who could even be called friends before they came together around Timbuktu. These four men, two whites and two blacks, also forged interracial bonds of friendship and alliance that were simply unprecedented in the 19th century and would not be repeated until well into the 20th century. Garrett Smith and John Brown stood apart from every other white man or woman on the historical record in their ability to not only to befriend blacks, but to embrace the idea of full political, social, and cultural equality for blacks. They were the only whites who refused to endorse through the 1850s the widespread, pervasive racist sentiments. They believed that blacks were every bit as equal to whites, and that they stood apart. They're also willing and able and wanting to live among them. Now, the central question that I ask in my book, which focuses on these four men, is how and why this happened. Given the horrible racism in America, given the fact that slavery was spreading throughout America, how and why was it that Garrett Smith and John Brown could seek to and choose to live among blacks, to identify themselves as black men, which they did, and to be willing to go to such great lengths to end slavery and oppression? And similarly, how and why was it that someone like Frederick Douglass and James McCune Smith could befriend and trust Garrett Smith, John Brown, and other whites, given the nature of the horrible barriers that existed in America at the time? And how and why were they able to retain their faith in America as a democratic and egalitarian and pluralist society? And in answering those questions go a long way toward understanding how and why Timbuktu came into being. And to understand that there were, all right, to understand that, I think we also need to understand the enormous differences that these four men. I mean, they would literally span the social spectrum. They could not have been farther apart. Frederick Douglass begins his life as a slave and becomes one of the most famous black men in the Western world. James McCune Smith starts his life as a very poor black man and ends up becoming the most educated black in the Western world. John Brown starts his life as an artisan and then a businessman and becomes a failed bankrupt. And Garrett Smith starts his life as one of the wealthiest men in the country. And so they span the social spectrum. But the events surrounding the Panic of 1837 and subsequent depression became an important precondition for them being able to come together in the first place. The Panic of 1837 and subsequent depression was one of the worst in American history. A number of historians have likened it to the Great Depression of the 30s, or have said that it's even worse than the Great Depression. The Panic and Depression, which really lasted until 1844, shook American culture at its roots. Garrett Smith, who grows up as one of the wealthiest men in the country, he inherits his land from Peter Smith. Peter Smith, his father, had been a business partner with John Jacob Astor, and Astor and Peter Smith had been fur traders together. They first made their money trading fur, then Astor acquired most of what is now New York City, or Manhattan rather, and Peter Smith amassed roughly 1 million acres of land in western New York and upstate New York. Garrett Smith inherited this money. The panic was so devastating that Garrett Smith found himself at the brink of bankruptcy, and in fact only a loan of $200,000 from John Jacob Astor saved him from insolvency. And in the wake of the panic, Garrett became radicalized. That's when he first defined himself as a radical abolitionist, a fanatic, an outsider, and an outlaw. And so you see Garrett Smith's social status descend in the wake of the panic. John Brown, the exact same thing happened too, except even on a more extreme level. John Brown went bankrupt following the panic, and really, from a material standpoint, never recovered. By contrast, Frederick Douglass and James McCune Smith saw new worlds opening up for them in the wake of the panic and the depression. Frederick Douglass escaped slavery in 1838, and while speculative, I've suggested that because of the economic circumstances that were happening in Baltimore, where Douglass was a slave, that the economy facilitated his ability to achieve freedom. And by 1845, when he published his narrative of Frederick Douglass, narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, he was already famous. So he achieved an enormous social ascent, and James McCune Smith, precisely when the panic hit in May of 1837, returns to New York as the first professionally trained black physician, having received his MD degree from University of Glasgow, Scotland, a very prestigious university, establishes a medical practice on West Broadway in New York. It's an interracial medical practice. He's also the first black physician. And so he sees his own career achieving a remarkable social ascent as well. So as a result of the panic, you have the two white men descend in social rank and the two black men ascend, and it represents a precondition, so it allows them to come together. And specifically what happened is, following the panic and the depression, they all defined themselves as outsiders, as social outsiders. And that's crucially important because it allowed them to stand apart totally from the status quo and to be able to not only critique American society, but to seek to replace it with a better vision of society. Garrett Smith and John Brown begin their careers as insiders, as white men. Frederick Douglass and James McCune Smith begin their career as outsiders. But as Garrett and Brown descend in social rank, they become outsiders as well, and they retain their insider status because Garrett never loses his degree of, never loses complete social power, and Brown also retains a degree of social power. The problem with being a complete outsider is that you have no power. So ultimately what these four men do is they define themselves as social outsiders with insider status, with the ability to try to change their society and their country. They also, in the wake of the panic and the depression, also define themselves as prophets and as millennialists. Their vision of this new society that would be interracial and integrated was a new age. It was a heaven on earth. It was how they would get from an existing material world that was marinated in sin to this utopian millennialist state. And so they saw themselves as instruments in God's hand, seeking to pave the way to this new world. They embraced the idea of what I call sacred self-sovereignty, meaning that they conceived of the kingdom of God as being within them and of being within, theoretically, within all people, and that the kingdom of God was also literally kind of defined in national terms, that ultimately the kingdom of God would become America. The immediate abolition of all sin was their most passionate desire. And that the fact that they sought to abolish all sin meant that they were really seeking this new world, this new dispensation. They were able to imagine a sharp break from the past. While slavery existed today, tomorrow could be another story. While Timbuktu was this settlement of 100 people or 100 or so people today, tomorrow or next week or next month, it could literally spread throughout the entire country. They believed this, and the power of belief for them was central in their ability to retain their faith in America. They were also able to invert the notion of color symbolism. For example, James McCune Smith, soon after he began working with Garrett Smith on the land, argued that before equality could be achieved in America, there first had to be a profound shift in the heart of whites. He said the heart of whites must be changed, thoroughly, entirely, permanently changed. And he went on to suggest that before America could become an egalitarian country, whites had to be able to imagine themselves as black. They had to be able to view the world as if they were black. They had to shed their sense of social superiority that was based on their white skin. And they had to acquire, in effect, a black heart. Hence the title of my book, The Black Hearts of Men, and my meaning of inverting the color symbolism. Garrett Smith admirably embraced the idea of what he called the black-hearted measures of slaves and their quest to run away and to steal from their masters and to kill their masters if necessary. Garrett Smith continually, there are numerous instances in Garrett's correspondence where he seeks to make myself a colored man, as he puts it. Frederick Douglass and James McKean Smith recognized that Garrett Smith and John Brown, while they were white men, they were in sympathy colored men. So the idea of black hearts or blackness became the arbiter of goodness and the arbiter, the standard of benevolence and righteousness. And it anticipated the notion of black as beautiful that came about during the civil rights era of the 1960s. And so through the ability to define themselves as prophets, embrace sacred self-sovereignty, they were able, and invert color symbolism, they were able to imagine and to seek to realize a heaven on earth and a new age that was defined by America. And Timbuktu became the most tangible example of their efforts to realize this heaven on earth.